Welcome to All Analytics Radio. This is Jim Connolly. I'm editor of allanalytics.com. You only have to check out any news website today or any news broadcast or newspaper to get a sense of why the current presidential election campaign is the craziest in decades. Just this week, we're witnessing wild nights at the Republican convention, which sets the stage for the Democratic convention next week, in another 3 months of head-to-head debates and accusations between Trump and Clinton. There will be equally intense races on smaller platforms for more than 450 congressional seats as well this fall. But suppose for a minute that much of what seems like mayhem is actually pretty carefully calculated, with messaging designed to appeal to key segments of the voting population. Suppose that much of the bluster is actually shaped by our favorite topic here on All Analytics, and that is data. Our guest today has been looking at the role of data and analytics play in elections. Rick Hutley is director of the analytics program at the University of Pacific. He put his master's program candidates to work researching how analytics are changing the way politicians campaign. Welcome, Rick. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you, Jim.
Great. As you might detect from Rick's accent, he definitely doesn't have his roots in the Midwest. So we will carve out a bit of time from our talk at some point and ask him about that Brexit vote that everybody has followed. But before we get into the discussion, let me add a note for the listeners. You can post questions for Rick and comments for your peers on the live chat box on the All Analytics streaming audio page. I'll share as many of the questions as I can with Rick during the live audio session, and then we'll address a few more during the chat session at the bottom of the hour. So, Rick, let's get started. The most visible use of analytics in elections has traditionally been where experts try to predict winners. But as you told me when we first met, that's only a small part of the story. How are candidates leveraging data today?
Well, it's a very broad question, Jim. So, yes, it certainly started with, or at least the most visible component over the years, has been election prediction from folks like Nate Silver, who's excellent and brilliant at predicting who's going to win or lose. And that certainly remains a very big component of election analytics. But data provides insight into far more than just who's winning and losing. Clearly, campaign managers, more so than the candidates per se, it is the campaign management team that are monitoring data from a whole variety of sources to look at everything from is their candidate winning and losing, but also why are they winning or losing? In what areas are they winning or losing? Geographic areas, topic areas, and so forth. They're looking at everything from voter sentiment through to advertising return and impact and so forth. So pretty much every aspect of running a political campaign is amenable to analytics. You capture the data, perform the analytics, and see what it tells you. And from there, you can then make sound campaign decisions.
How has the data sourcing and actually the data tools changed? I mean, obviously, our audience sees a lot of this in their day-to-day lives in the business world. What types of new sources are the campaigns tapping?
Well, I think the biggest change, and again, many of your audience will have heard of the phrase big data. Not a particularly descriptive term per se, but as you say, analytics that we're going to talk about with when it comes to politics and elections is the same form of analytics. It's the same opportunity that every industry, every company is seeing today. What's changed over the past few years is simply the breadth of information and data that's available and the volume. So big data is often characterized by what they call the three V's. The volume of data that's available today is just astronomical. It's unbelievable how much information is available to us. Secondly is the velocity, the speed at which that information is becoming available. It's now real time, and in the past, data tended to be what we would call batch mode. It was stuff that you got at the end of the day, end of the week, end of the month. Now it's real time, minute by minute, even second by second. And then the variety of information is different than it was not so many years ago. If you were a corporation, leave politics to one side for a moment, the type of data that you had access to 3, 4, 5 years ago was your internal data. It was your sales data, your marketing data, your transactional data. But it was your data, and that's all you had visibility to. Today, we have access to a whole variety of data sources, some of them made free and available by the government, things like employment statistics, traffic information, weather information, and so forth. And, of course, the really big one that's now available to politicians and the rest of the world at large is social media data. So we can now literally tap into the public, if you will, and begin to understand what are they thinking and saying. And when you bring those things together, the fact that I can get vast amounts of information across the entire US population in real time through their social media messaging and understand what they're thinking and saying and how they're reacting to the messages that we're putting out on a speech or in the news print or whatever. So that's fundamentally what's changed over the past few years, is the enormous amount of information, the variety, and the speed at which we can get it.
Now, are candidates able to get this real-time data, for example, in a situation like a televised debate? You have an hour to make your points and to trash your opponents. Are the teams able to feed reaction data to the candidate as they're talking or in between questions?
Yes, that's perfectly feasible. For example, any one of us, even as individual members of the public, can tap into sources such as Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and various other social media channels. Of course, you and I, using that free channel, are limited to the amount of information we can get. But if you're a corporation or a political campaign manager and you're paying your subscription fees, you can again get access to vast quantities of that data. And it's happening in real time. I literally can get people's reaction to what was said within seconds. I can hear or see what their reaction is and have programs that will sum all of that together. And absolutely, you could feed that through to a candidate while they're on stage if you wanted to. Now, whether a campaign management team would want to feed live information to their candidate while they're making the speech is a different question. That might derail their thinking or disrupt their conversation, etc. But it's technically feasible. Excuse me. Certainly the campaign team behind the scenes can be monitoring that in real time and understand how well certain messages did or didn't go down well with the candidate.
Now, I know you put your grad students to work on examining the use of election analytics. What did you learn? How did that shape their education? And will you continue doing it?
A lot, and oh yes. So first of all, you know, at the University of the Pacific, the students are undertaking a master's degree in data science. So these are budding data scientists who are learning how to take all of that information we've been talking about and write the algorithms and the computer programs that will crunch the data and produce those insights and visualizations. Everything from clustering analysis in terms of which clusters are reacting in which way, you know, do we have a geographic spread or divide, or is it a topic-based divide? So how does our audience cluster, if you will, through to things like machine learning? And can we use predictive analytics to predict some of the things that are going to happen? So right now, we run that degree in San Francisco. Actually, we're launching in Sacramento in January as well. But what the students are studying and on the political side is we got a variety of data for them to play with, if you will. And they were looking at things such as the debate speeches. Now, the wonderful thing with debates, public televised debates, is you can be 100% sure of the data because it's recorded. It's on TV. It's live. So it's not someone's interpretation, and it's not data that could be misleading. It's factual data. And so the students were able to take that information and perform a variety of analyses upon that. For example, who speaks most on the campaign trail? Now, it would be fairly simple to say, well, person X speaks more than person Y, but you have to also factor in the opportunity for someone to speak. So some candidates are on more more stages than others. Some candidates are on stage with only a couple of opponents. Others are on stage with, say, 5 or 10 components. So their opportunity to speak changes. So our students have to learn how to, first of all, take the data, but then also normalize it and understand how the data should be interpreted. And from that, they were able to deduce such things as I say, who is speaking most, who speaks least, what the length of the sentence was a very interesting one. Who speaks in long sentences, who speaks in short sound bites, as well as the vocabulary that was used. Who uses a sophisticated and broad vocabulary versus those that use a simpler, shorter vocabulary. All of those provide very valuable insights into how the debates were conducted by each of the candidates. And if you then match that to the reaction data that I was talking about earlier, the kinds of reactions that the general public have to those speeches, you can begin to get insights as to whether or not longer sentences with a richer vocabulary is more effective for this audience versus a shorter, smaller vocabulary is more effective with a different audience. And those are very valuable insights to campaign managers and candidates.
Now, speaking of different audiences and different groups of voters, you know, throughout the primaries, there's been a lot of talk about the whole primary system and some pretty serious criticism of it. Now that we're heading towards the final election, there is similar criticism that's built up over the years of the Electoral College and how that system influences candidate strategies. For example, we know that a lot of candidates will not campaign in states that they know are solidly in their camp or solidly in the other camp, and they will simply concentrate their time on the swing states. So is that strategy still valid, or what role does data play in shaping those state-by-state strategies where, you know, what the message that resonates well in Maine isn't going to land well in California, for instance?
Yeah, I think data and analytics is going to fundamentally change some of this in terms of the granularity of those decisions. So the decisions may, in essence, remain the same. That is to say, if you know that a given state is, as it were, in your back pocket, then what's the point of campaigning? The problem in the past has been the granularity pretty much has been at the state level. It's like you kind of know that this state is with us, and, you know, so we don't need to worry too much about that one. Let's focus somewhere else. But as we're seeing in this election, we're getting some very unusual results. And in fact, there's nothing certain anymore. Can you indeed be certain that a given state is in your back pocket or not? But the point with data is we can now bring that type of thinking down to a much lower level. So instead of thinking this state is red or blue and therefore I don't need to worry, what if we could bring it down to a city and say, well, we do need to campaign in that state, but we don't need to go to that city or this one. This is the city we want to focus on. What if you could bring it down even further to an individual group within that city? Or potentially even down to individuals within the city. So no longer are you necessarily walking up and down a street knocking on every single door. Now maybe your analytics tell you which of the doors in that street you should knock on in order to maximize the impact of your campaign. So data, because we can get more of it at a much more granular level, we can start to understand not only at the state level, but almost down to the individual level as to where can we maximize our impact and with which message. It may be that I knock on one door and deliver one message, and the message I deliver to the next door I knock on is different because I happen to know that that household is influenced more by one message versus another.
That's interesting because even though the state may be solid one color, if you could swing even, you know, two of the good sized cities in that state, then you might change that whole state and get all their electoral votes.
Exactly. So when you, a state's a pretty big place. So when you say a state is one color or another, how much of that state is that particular color? How exposed is that state? If you think it's in your back pocket, just how exposed is it? Because if you ignore it completely, you may find that it swings against you and takes you unawares. So the more granular you can get, the more insight you will have. You will know where you are truly strong and why you are truly strong in that area. And that leads to much more informed decisions.
Now, listeners probably have heard in the past that President Obama's two national campaigns really revolutionized the use of election analytics. What was it that his team did that was really new?
Well, the 2008 election, I think, sort of led the way, but where it really changed was in 2012. So the concept of using data, of course, is not new. Every industry, including politics, has used it for as long as we've been able to get hold of data. But in 2012, the campaign manager or management team basically turned the whole campaign over to the data scientists. And what I mean by that is they made a conscious decision to say, we are going to allow the data fundamentally to guide us and tell us what to do. And that was a huge step. Up until that point, data was something you gave to the political experts who said, well, we've got years of experience. We've got gut instinct and intuition that tell us what to do. And yes, you give us the data, and we will apply all of our gut instinct and intuition. What the 2012 campaign said, the Obama campaign said, was let's just let the data guide us. That's not to say that intuition and experience don't play a role. They absolutely do. But nonetheless, the campaign said we are going to fundamentally allow the data to guide us and drive us. And that's what they did. They employed, I think it was just over 100 data scientists of various types. They brought all of the data together. In the past, data was divided, if you will. You know, those dealing with the electorate had one database, and those that were dealing with advertising and TV slots and so on had a different database, and so forth. So in 2012, what the Obama campaign did was bring all of that data together into one central database. And that was the first time where they were starting to get this richness, the big data richness of bringing all the different perspectives together into one place. That gave them new and creative insights, and it allowed them to manage the campaign holistically across every aspect of what they were doing. And it paid off big time.
Combine two questions here. One is, how have things changed in those 4 years? But also, if you look at, there's a question that came from the audience, and that is, if you look at what we've considered, traditional analytics for elections, how does the non-traditional campaign of Trump change that formula, and can the analytics systems that we have in place compensate for that type of campaign?
Yeah, I think the way in which, regardless of whether it's the Trump campaign, the Clinton campaign, and by the way, I'm non-political either which way here, having come, as you say, from outside of the U.S., regardless of your campaign per se, data and analytics provide insight. And it's how you use those insights in order to make the decisions that are aligned with your campaign that I think make the difference here. So compensate for the Trump approach or the non-traditional approach. His campaign, like any other, is as interested as any other in terms of what is the data telling us? What is our electorate and our electorate thinking? And there are some candidates who will say, well, that's interesting, but I don't care. I'm going to stick to my guns and I'm going to deliver my message whether the public like it or not. There are others that will be swayed very heavily by saying, well, if that's what they like, I will change my tack and change my message. And I will go with the popular vote, so to speak. Now, I'm not advocating whether either one of those approaches is right or wrong. And simply saying that the data and the analytics provide insight that then allow the campaign management team and the candidates to make the decisions that they feel are appropriate in line with their policies and approach, regardless of whether it's traditional or untraditional.
Now, I was curious as we approach this this program, thinking of the Trump campaign and a lot of what he said during the primaries and even into the convention time frame came across as unpredictable. Do you mm-hmm. think that he had data that showed him, here's how far I can go?
Let me answer this one somewhat carefully, Jim. Do I think he had data that showed him? Yeah, I'm sure they did. Again, both all of the candidates and their campaign teams are smart people. They're smart. They understand how to interpret data. So I'm sure he had data at his disposal. Again, with some candidates, that insight would sway them to say, well, I'm going to change the way I say things or do things. In other cases, candidates are more opinionated and saying, well, I frankly don't care. This is my message, and that's what I'm going to deliver. What was interesting, this is some work that we looked at, again, back to the analytics of speeches, was the breadth of vocabulary and the length of speech or sentence length that candidates were using. And one of the things that Trump does very effectively, he speaks with a very small vocabulary. I think he speaks, and most candidates are speaking at fifth, sixth grade level, and Trump speaks at more of a third grade level. And he speaks in very short sound bites, almost tweet level sound bites. Now, the advantage of that is that lower or smaller vocabulary is able to be understood and interpreted by everybody. If you use a much larger vocabulary and more sophisticated sentence structure, which tend to be longer, that is not so easily understood by some and is only understood by a few. And so one asks the question is, does Donald Trump truly have a smaller vocabulary than his opponents, or was it smart campaign management to say deliberately use this smaller vocabulary because you will reach a broader audience and a more grassroots audience? So these are the kinds of decisions that I'm sure campaign managers are debating with their candidates.
That actually touches on a question that just came in from the audience about whether you are seeing the use of text analytics in today's campaigns, which would seem to play into the whole type of language and length of sentence and so on.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, text analytics, there's a variety of analytics you can use, visual and so forth, but text analytics, because it's a very common and popular medium for, you know, for us, for the grassroots voters out here. The campaign management team, of course, have access to TVs and goodness knows what, but you and I communicate, for the most part, via text, emails and tweets and blogs and so forth. And so text analytics, and in particular sentiment analytics of text, is very important. That is what's telling these campaign managers what's resonating with the potential voter. And again, is that broken down, or can we break that down by geographic region, or maybe gender, maybe nationality, maybe interest groups of various types? But looking at that text, and as I said earlier, you can do this in real time. You can pull these tweets down in real time and understand what people are saying right now. The other interesting thing with a lot of this information is you're observing what people are saying to each other as opposed to what they're saying to the candidate. And that can sometimes give you a lot of insight in terms of what's really on people's minds, looking at the debate between various people.
Let me just take you out to the international scene for a second and ask you, with so much data available these days, why was the vote for the UK to leave the EU such a surprise for everyone?
Well, actually, there is something of a parallel between that and the US elections. In my opinion, the reason that came as such a surprise is no one truly believed that the vote would go the way it did. And so a lot of people just frankly didn't bother voting. There was certainly a large number that voted without really thinking about the implications, and who have since publicly come forward and say, I really regret the fact that I voted to leave because I didn't really want to leave. I didn't really believe that. I never really thought it would happen, so I thought I'd have some fun and threw my vote in. And now they're saying, whoa, it went completely against what we expected. And in retrospect, there are many people saying, if I could do it all over again, I would put a lot more thought into it, and I wouldn't vote the way that I have. And I think there's a parallel here with the U.S. elections. And again, I would stress here, Jim, I'm not politically biased one way or the other, truly. But there were many people that said, you know, we never expected Donald Trump to be where he is today. There was a point where everybody thought, well, it's going to be Jeb Bush. I mean, you know, he's got all the money and he's got the connections and so forth. And Trump was almost an interesting sideline. And, of course, that's proven not to be the case. So Brexit, I think, took a lot of people by surprise because they simply didn't believe that that could possibly be the outcome of a referendum.
People might have been surprised that their vote actually counted.
Yes, it's a message for society at large, eh?
Rick, let me ask you, you know, obviously, you know, we get into the elections on All Analytics as sort of a sidelight. We really try to focus more on business. So what can a business or a nonprofit learn about analytics from what the campaign teams are doing?
Good question. The one thing about data and analytics is it's everywhere. And it's in every industry, every function that you perform within a company, any company, is dependent upon information and today analytics. So business decisions, or personal decisions for that matter, every decision you make is based upon information. If you make a decision without information, you're just guessing. And sometimes we have to guess. But by and large, we make decisions based upon information of everything from where should we go and eat tonight to which political candidate should I vote for, or should we buy this product or not buy this product. So that's the first thing. It applies to every industry and every function of every company. Second, the whole issue of big data is amenable to everybody. In the past, large corporations were the only ones who could really afford to purchase the databases and data sets that allowed them to do any form of meaningful analytics. Today, much of that information is available free, firstly from the government, and secondly from the social media sources and so forth. And so most companies, most individuals, now have the ability to do very sophisticated analytics. The tools that are available to us today are indeed very powerful compared to what they were in the past, which again opens up that opportunity. So my guidance to companies as I go around the world is data is critical. You need to have a data strategy. You need to have an analytics strategy. And you need analytics skill sets. One of the things, for example, that I'm running in San Francisco and Sacramento is executive workshops to talk about exactly that. These are 2-3-day workshops to talk about what is big data, what is the Internet of Things, how do I do analytics, how do I manage an analytics team and leverage analytics and so forth. Secondly, you really need a data analytics team, and that's why we're running the master's degrees at the University of the Pacific, is because the world is in desperate need for more and more data scientists. Indeed, McKinsey predicted that by 2018, the demand for data scientists will outstrip supply by over 60% and growing. So there's a mad rush on right now to build data science teams that can perform these kinds of analytics and keep you ahead of the competition. So it's big business for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Great. Hey, Rick, we've actually used up our time slot here. I want to thank you for the great information, and we're going to stay in touch between now and November through blogs and perhaps another show. It'll be interesting to see what evolves in terms of the elections over the next few months. And we can see how the final campaigns take advantage of analytics. So I want to thank Rick. I want to thank Rick Hutley, director of the analytics program at the University of Pacific, for being with us today. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and to SAS for sponsoring this event. This has been Jim Connolly for All Analytics Radio and UBM Tech. Thank you for tuning in, and Rick, thank you for sharing your experiences.
It's a pleasure.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Jim.